Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Apogeospatial Podcast. With advances in AI and machine learning happening every day, the question as to where ethics exists within these innovations has never been more important than it is right now. In this episode of the podcast, Myrna discusses with Will Griffin of Hypergiant Industries these pressing issues and more. Join me as we listen in on their conversation.
Hi, everyone. This is Myrna James Yu with Apogeospatial Magazine. Really excited to be here today with Will Griffin with Hypergiant, which is one of the new, very cutting-edge AI companies focused on developing world-changing technology to solve the world's biggest problems in the areas of space, defense, and critical infrastructure. There's a lot of overlap there with Apogeospatial because, as you guys know, we are about geospatial data, and now with data fusion, and you know, these are the technologies that are enabling solving the world's biggest problems. So I'm really thrilled to be speaking with Will about specifically about ethics in AI. But first, let's hear an introduction. I'd love for you to introduce yourself, Will.
Will Griffin, Chief Ethics Officer at Hypergiant Industries, and I'm super excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Give me an idea about your past, about how you came to this position. And I'm fascinated because ethics in AI is a fairly new field. So I'd just love to hear a little bit about your trajectory.
Yep. So, well, I've always been interested in what I would consider to be cutting edge industries. And my background has primarily been in media. I went to a science and math high school here in Austin, Texas. And then from there, I went to Dartmouth College, which was one of the early, it's a place where the early internet was created. A bunch of programming languages were created. And we were one of the first campuses to actually be wired with an intranet that connected to the internet. And so that was one of the things that was attractive to me about it, that it was, you know, as a cutting edge college. And then from there, I went to Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, and I worked in a pretty innovative group, which was called asset-backed securities. Included in it was mortgage-backed securities, which ultimately blew up the globe in 2008. So when I was there in the early 90s, that's when we, you know, began to create all those financial instruments like collateralized mortgage obligations, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, et cetera. Obviously, I left long before it blew up, but at the time, it was an exciting place to be on Wall Street. And then from there, I went to Harvard for law school. Also did a year's worth of courses at the business school in the entrepreneurship curriculum. And then went into McKinsey & Company, where I was consulting media, primarily large media companies, including Disney, Time Warner, Turner, especially at that time. There was a lot of industry consolidation, so most of the work we were doing was post-merger integration. But we did some fun stuff, like for Disney, we helped launch the new theme park, California Adventure, which was a lot of fun. And then went to go work at a company, News Corporation, which still is, but many of the parts are sold off. But at the time, it was an exciting company because we were continuing to aggregate and grow. So at the time, we owned DirecTV, B-Sky-B, almost all of the satellite delivery companies, at least in the English-speaking world. And then, you know, launched some other things I'm not super proud of, but they were successful, like Fox News was launching at that time, in addition to, you know, a bunch of other companies, a lot of interactive stuff then. And then since then, I've been in, you know, small companies. I find it to be more exciting, and I feel like your work can have a lot of impact on the company itself. And then if you're in a growing industry, then your company can have an impact on the industry. So I've been at Hypergiant for 2 years. I was attracted to the vision of our founder and CEO, Ben Lamb. And he kind of has a mantra, which is delivering the future we were promised, which is to use technologies in ways that it has been envisioned. And that's like, you know, the flying cars, human beings able to go to space, using technology in a clean way that can help solve the climate crisis and other challenges that are faced by humanity. In order for us to accomplish that mission, you know, Ben suggested to me, and I actually agree, that ethics will be the defining line of whether technology ultimately has a beneficial impact for humanity, or it becomes a stumbling block for humanity, which pits human beings against each other ultimately. And so the goal is to be on the right side of history, operationalize ethics into our workflows, and do it in a way that it becomes an example for the rest of the industry.
That is so, so, so important. I love your really broad and deep experience. You know, most people have said of either one or the other, right? I really, really appreciate your background and your experience. I remember when Time Warner was merging with AOL. I worked at Time Warner right around then, or I guess right prior to that, actually. In Chicago at Parenting Magazine back in the day.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, that's so, yeah,
in the 90s, right? In the 90s.
So for, right, so you worked for Time Life.
Yeah, I worked for Time Warner at the time. And then they were merging with AOL, and I, you know, it was the beginning of the internet, right? And I literally did sort of have this intuition that this is not going to go well.
Right.
It took a few years to play out, but ultimately I was right. So it's kind of funny. My background is more traditional publishing. But now, you know, after 18 years of working in the geospatial industry by owning this magazine, I have a very broad, you know, view of how data, especially geospatial data, is being used. So, you know, it's all coming together. I just want to kind of make a point for my listeners and the people who read Apogee Spatial regularly and now listen to it as we're doing more podcasts. I just want to make the point that, you know, all the data, all different kinds of data that's out there is being merged and fused together. And now these days, whatever project you're working on is going to have geospatial data as an underlying layer almost no matter what, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like GPS being embedded into everything we do as well. You know, we don't even know it's embedded, but it is. And then we have, you know, benefits from that on our smartphone or whatever. So that is fantastic. And it's true. Ethics will be the defining line of the future for success, but also for ultimately having these projects benefit humanity, right? I mean, I think if you drill down, is that what we're talking about? Causing harm for humanity or not?
Well, that's what it comes down to. So our framework basically has three core elements to it, and it's based on Immanuel Kant's deontological perspective. So the first step is goodwill. Is there a positive intent for the use case? There, the use case owner, or in this case, the designer and the developer of the particular AI, the burden of proof is on them to say there's a positive intent for the technology that they intend to develop and deploy. Once you clear that hurdle, you go to the second phase, which is the categorical imperative, which is a maxim, which says that if every company in your industry, every industry in the world, use technology in the way that you contemplate, what impact would it have on the world? So what this does is it requires the use case owner to not just think of its constituency or its stakeholders as just the client or just the first user of the technology, but you have to think of the second and third and fourth order effects on humanity and the rest of society with the technology when it's deployed. And then the third step is the law of humanity, which many people know of as are people being used as a means to an end, or is the intent of the technology to benefit people. So that's where we start. Those three, you have to answer those three questions in an affirmative way before we'll move forward with the project. And if you can't answer those three in an affirmative way, then either the project is modified, which happens most of the time, or the project itself is shelved. If companies ask that question, it creates a situation where all of humanity becomes a stakeholder to the technology, and then you will feel like you owe obligations to all of humanity, and then that will impact the way you design, develop, and deploy the technology.
Right. That is shifting, walking through that process, those three kind of screens, right? Walking through that process for your potential clients, I'm sure you said most of them do have to tweak it or make changes to make sure. That's really great, because you're helping them before you even start to reframe and think through the long-term implications. And that's so important, because what I'm most afraid of is, you know, that some of these things will, some of the AI that's out there for, with different applications, you know, is sort of being unleashed without that guidance and without that.
Well, and we saw it happen. So in a,
yeah,
in a couple of, you know, I've been in, you know, a couple of different eras where we saw people or industry actors try to get off of the moral question by saying that there were unintended consequences. So obviously the Silicon Valley mantra is move fast, break things. But Silicon Valley didn't invent that. That was also Wall Street's mantra, which was
where you have a lot of experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So move fast, make money. The innovation is always ahead of the ability to regulate or policymakers. So when you're in the innovation world, a lot of times people have been able to get off the moral hook by saying, oh, these are unintended consequences. So two examples in my background are, one, when I worked in the mortgage-backed securities group at Goldman Sachs, when we were creating derivatives and collateralized mortgage obligations, asset-backed securities, no one could forecast that the urge to make money or the greed factor would ultimately lead to a situation where credit was going to be made too easy to borrowers who weren't necessarily credit worthy. And these packages were going to be sold off to mom and pop investors and institutional investors in a secondary market when those loans became securitized. Ultimately,
yeah,
it led to a lot of non-performing loans or people who couldn't pay the notes, or created situations where there are adjustable rate mortgages where people didn't understand the loans that they were taking. So ultimately, the entire mortgage market collapsed in 2008.
Yeah.
If you would have forecast, if you would have gone through the what I call TOME or top of mind ethics, which is the framework that I just laid out, if that was top of mind, then we could have perceived, well, if we have easy credit, then people would take that easy credit, even if they weren't able to pay those loans. If that happened and those products were available all over the world, what would happen? Too many people would take loans that they ultimately couldn't afford. And if we knew we were selling those bad loans essentially off to mom and pop investors, it was foreseeable that there would eventually become a crash. But there was no ethical vetting done at the time that those products were unleashed.
That's amazing, right? I mean, you're saying that that could have been avoided if you even had these processes you're talking about now with the top of mind ethics process. If those things had been considered, that would have been avoided. The Big
Absolutely.
Short in 2008 would have been avoided. The housing crisis, the housing bubble would have been avoided.
Absolutely. 2008 doesn't happen if in 1992, 93, 94, this level of vetting was done.
Yeah.
So that's the goal. The goal is to do things, is to use the same imagination that creates innovative products is the same imagination that should be used to foresee the impacts on our stakeholders, which we consider all of humanity.
I have a question. I'd love for your comment on what's happening with what just happened with GameStop stock and the versus Wall Street, kind of Main Street versus Wall Street, what just happened. Please just share your wisdom.
Well, I think what happened with GameStop, let's take once in the big picture. Ultimately, what happens is Wall Street, hedge funds, institutional investors is essentially playing a game. And that
right.
game is basically use the information that they have about the market and about the individual companies to create wins for themselves, which is the opportunity to make money. Now that information is becoming more widely distributed, individual investors are also seeing how that game works.
Right. And
so
especially after being exposed with 2008, I mean, that's
yeah,
one thing that they understand how shorting works now.
And being exposed to video games and being exposed to social media, where the higher your follower count is, the more successful you are. And mm-hmm. being able to communicate and aggregate themselves
right.
in a way that they felt like that they could also play the game in a way that they can consolidate their individual accounts into a form of market power.
Yep.
And so in the process, the actual companies themselves and the employees and the traditional investors in those companies basically have become pawns in a game between the hedge funds and the individual investors. I personally don't think that there is a morally superior actor in that, because there's nothing about the actions on either side that are linked to actual true underlying fundamental value.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. Really, just technology, internet, Reddit, self-organizing has allowed individuals to, at least, as you said, play the game because they joined forces and then they were able to influence the market. But yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? I was really fascinated watching all that happen.
The underlying companies are going to be, and their employees are going to be ultimate loser in that, because inevitably, the actual true value of GameStop will be revealed.
Yeah.
And when that happens, everyone who doesn't get out of the game in time will be burned.
So the reason
why I say it is because there's a huge information asymmetry. Hedge funds have these large Bloomberg terminals and access to all the data. These individual investors in Reddit and those rooms have aggregated a certain segment of the data that they need to execute the strategy that they want. Now, there are other people who are hearing about it on social media who are hopping in. They don't have access to this data. They're not able to follow along. So they're just lemmings who are riding a wave, and they won't know when the game's over.
Yeah, dangerous. Maybe there's one little shining light is maybe GameStop's value will be at least higher than it would have been from the visibility, because maybe people in general will go out and shop there more, right? you never know.
Right.
It's certainly given them a lot of visibility. And I have a 15-year-old son, and we go to GameStop.
Yeah. I mean, but the fundamentals are against that business.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
gotcha.
In the same way that the fundamentals were against Blockbuster.
Of course. Yep. Yep. Gotcha. Thank you for that. It's a little side note there. So I have a couple questions specifically around AI ethics, and I'd love to hear from you. I know, of course, trust is a big issue. People need to trust the data, the initial data that goes into the machine learning and the AI, and people need to trust that there's a guiding light, like the tome that you mentioned, the top of mind ethics. Can you talk a little bit about trust?
Well, the whole game is the whole objective is to engender trust. So a mantra that we use around here is that ethics equals trust, and it's the trust that leads to economic value creation. And that's true from the early trading relationships in the Mesopotamia Valley, in this river valley. The early trading systems all was based on trust. There were no credit scores. You didn't have a credit history. It was all basically on your reputation. And that is the way when we moved from a hunter and gathering society to agricultural societies and became a more sedentary society, all of human survival was based on the trust that from your labor, we would trade what was created for something that we need, and then we would produce something that you need. All of civilization was built on trust.
And
when
the agreement of value, right? The agreement of
the
value
agreement
as well.
The exchange of value, completely, yes. And that we trust that you will deliver what it is that you say you will deliver, and we will deliver what it is that we say we deliver. Without those early trading relationships and trust, civilization would have been impossible, because no single groups of human beings are able to produce all of the things that you need to live and survive. So trading was a requirement.
And we also need transparency, right? It brings up the need for transparency of information, data, background, whatever. And then that also leads me to blockchain. And in the future, where we're going, right, with everything is to a new technology that's the blockchain, where all the information is visible to everyone. If changes are made to a transaction, it's visible, right?
Transparency is hugely important, but it still boils down to trust, because it becomes impossible for an individual human or individual communities to verify. So even if it's somebody should be able to verify, even if it's not me. So going back to what you described, which is your kind of core focus area, which is geospatial data. We don't know. Not everybody knows how GPS works.
Right.
We just agree. You're on Mountain Time. I'm on Central Time. We agree that we're going to talk at 11:15 my time, 10:15 your time. We don't know exactly how GPS works to set that time. We've just made an agreement.
Yeah.
Right? So in your world, there is now a competitive system to GPS. So China has created their own system of GPS because they don't, it's a geopolitical power struggle, because they don't like the rest of the world essentially being on our time. So
right.
They've created a competitor to GPS, and they're trying to get countries to subscribe to their time. It's kind of like the, mm-hmm. It's kind of like the metric system, versus our system.
Right. And time and space, right? There's a time element, yes. And then this where on the earth are we? Right. Location, time, space. It's all a continuum. It's all.
And all of the phones, all of our phones are linked to it. Cable systems.
Yeah.
Pretty much all of civilization, at least in the Western world, has agreed on GPS. But
right. There
are very few people who could honestly articulate to you. I'm sure
how
you can, because you're an expert in the space, but most people can't articulate how it works.
Yeah. And there's Galileo, a system out of Europe. And
And we just trust that there are people who are going to be out there to verify. So
right. One
of the things, at least in our world, in AI and blockchain, I would consider to be part of those emerging technologies, is there's a whole movement towards transparency. But the real question is, transparency to who? Because
right. The
majority of society is not going to be able to verify, even if you put all of the code out there. So there's always still this element of trust, which is why we try to evangelize to the developers and the designers. The burden of proof is not on the fact checkers. It's not on the regulators. It's not on the general public. The burden of proof is on the developers and the designers to be creative and imagine all of its impacts on the rest of society and create a technology in a way that minimizes those impacts and maximizes the benefits.
That's a really good point, that even with transparency, you still have to have the underlying trust, right? Yeah.
Right. So social media. So that's the second world kind of that I was in. I was at a company called E-Universe. We subsequently, when we went public, it was this Intermix Media. And within there, we had a company called MySpace. And so MySpace was the first company, there was a company called Friendster, which came and went pretty quickly. But MySpace was kind of the first social media company to really catch fire. On the back end of that, we were able to aggregate all of this personal data. Keep in mind, this is when people put up personal profiles and they described everything about themselves on these applications. And people began to expose themselves in ways that we hadn't seen on the internet. In a lot of personal ways. Well, anyway, so all of that data, there were implied consent forms and privacy forms, but there was no way that the kids on that platform or young adults on that platform would be able to understand what rights they were giving away. And to be honest,
right. There
was no way that the early MySpace and Facebook and Friendster technologies could understand even the value of the data they were getting. Like, it wasn't a data mining operation. It was an eyeball aggregation operation.
Then, right. It literally was just advertising at the time.
It was eyeballs and traffic and page views. Mm-hmm. That was the whole game. Until advertisers then began to ask for the actual data, and targeting became more important. And so when that happens, consumers had no way of knowing how their data was going to be used. And even if they couldn't imagine it. So the goal then was, the burden was really on the developers and designers. And what we're trying to do now in this current environment with Facebook, Facebook is the biggest, but Facebook and Twitter is now we're trying to retrofit regulations onto an innovation that has become so massive. And one of the main triggers and reasons why we're doing this is because now we realize adversarial actors have figured it out and they're exploiting the system. And greed and the profit motive has come into the picture. And so the companies themselves have become bad actors. And now we're trying to retrofit regulations on it. So the goal for ethics and tech in our program is to bake ethics into the development and design process so we can forecast the impacts on our constituency, which we believe is all of humanity.
Right, right. That makes sense. And with one of the quotes from the Facebook debacle with The Social Dilemma, which was the Netflix documentary about this, it's fairly astonishing that they say, oh, well, we didn't intend for this to happen. We didn't intend for our AI to run amok, basically. Right. But whether you intend to or not, it's happening. So there has to be some accountability there.
Yeah. And so the accountability has to be two ways. One is we've seen in the mortgage crisis how difficult it is to retrofit ethics onto innovation. And we've seen with social media how difficult it is to retrofit ethics into a situation to create accountability, which is why the burden is now on all innovations going forward. Ethics needs to be baked into the way you design and develop, and you have to use your creativity and innovation to forecast all the things that could go wrong. So the question that needs to be answered, which is to your point of accountability, what happens when you don't use your imagination to forecast the things that go wrong and protect society against it? What are the penalties? Well, in the old days, in the early trading societies and agricultural societies, well, if you sell me something or trade something with me that has no value, I stop trading with you. And that in and of itself could represent an existential threat to you, because now if you don't get food or energy or other supplies or services, you can't survive. Well, in this world, because the wealth has been created in such a way and hoarded in such a way that even if one constituency leaves you, you still have other constituencies, so your survival is not at stake, which is now becomes the question that the regulators have to answer. So if I have a privacy violation in Europe and I violate GDPR, if you're Facebook, a $5 billion fine. Well, Facebook has a couple hundred billion dollars on its balance sheet. That $5 billion is just the cost of doing business. By breaching the trust with society, the penalty is not big enough. It doesn't represent an existential threat enough for you to change your behavior. So I forecast over the next couple of years, the penalties will be ratcheted up in such a way that breaching the trust and causing harm to society will ultimately lead to companies being penalized out of business. Otherwise, there's really no deterrent to the behavior.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I just have a couple more questions for you. The next thing I wanted to ask about, there's another documentary called The Coded Bias, and it's really about the unethical facial recognition biases that exist. Yep. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Yeah.
I'd love your comment on that as well. I mean, it's like an example of something being baked in that is inappropriate, right?
Well, that's actually great work. And Joy at the Algorithms Justice League, is really the lead person on that. It brought to and it was brought to light in two ways. So I feel like that's one of the best ways to use evangelism, because Coded Bias was out, but Coded Bias was also supported by the research that they did at MIT. So they were able to use the nomenclature and speak in the language that engineers could understand. While at the same time, we're in a pandemic, then George Floyd happens, then it becomes clear to everyone in society at large how facial recognition was being used to track down protesters. Essentially, that's how the issue was highlighted. Law enforcement was using facial recognition to track down protesters. Once that happened, in a zeitgeist moment when all of the world was paying attention, then the scrutiny turned back to the use of facial recognition, then the MIT work and the things that were highlighted in coded bias became clear to everyone that this is not an isolated incident, that this inaccurate and biased technology is being used all over the country and is negatively impacting lives. The blowback was so substantial in that moment that, as you know, IBM pulled out of the facial recognition business altogether. Amazon and Microsoft announced one-year moratorium on selling facial recognition to law enforcement, and a lot of municipalities around the country pulled their facial recognition programs, including the city of Detroit, which is a majority black city, had a 94% error rate.
Oh my gosh.
The accuracy of their facial recognition. So that's an example of how ethicists who are well-versed in the engineering side of it and well-versed in the technology can communicate a problem and an issue. And once it becomes commonly known among the constituency or the general public, then they can act in a way that causes the designers and developers to act, which is what happened.
Right.
To me, that's one of the most powerful case studies of how it's always worth it to point out unethical behavior on the part of companies, because if you get a large enough constituency, it can cause them to act. It can make the penalties large enough that they have no choice but to either pull or modify the technology. We're going to see more of that. Like there are cases all over the country right now. I'm teaching a course at Penn State Law School on ethics and AI, and one of the cases that we're going to talk about is the Upwork case in the UK. So basically, because of the pandemic, students weren't able to take their end of the year standardized tests. In the UK, those standardized tests are just as important, or even more so important than they are here, because they determine the placement in college and university. Well, instead, they created an algorithm that would guess what your score would have been based on your individual grades and based on the scores of the people who have come from your high school in past years.
Oh my gosh.
Obviously, there were so many flaws in the design of this program.
What was that called? I'm sorry. What was the program called?
Upqual. OFQAL. So that's basically the Department of Education in the UK.
Okay.
Well, anyway, when the scores came back, they were so off and out of line with the individual students. But the worst part was, if you were from a majority minority school, and you say you were a killer student at a minority school, because of the past test scores at your school, your scores were projected lower than they would have been if you had set. Anyway, but enough people were affected by it that there were actually riots in the streets of the UK that ultimately led the Department of Education to change that policy and to get rid of those scores. So now the students now had an option of taking those scores if they liked the scores that the algorithm created, or getting a teacher to create a score for them based on their body.
Oh my goodness.
But anyway, that's just an example of the types of ways that the algorithms are going to get people to take to the streets.
Right. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. I know that I did another interview a few weeks ago with Matthew Bailey. His new book is about ethics in AI, and his company is AIethics.world. And I've been learning more about this from them as well, from Maria McAndrews, who I just interviewed as well. And it's so just fascinating to learn more about these subjects and how deep it goes. And just, have to reiterate, I know I spoke with you about this earlier. This is just so important. I think this is one of the most important, if not the most important issues, in tech right now, because we can't just allow these machines, computers, to just run amok without having some kind of stopgap for them and some sort of fence around it. So I just wanted to ask one last thing. Is there anything else that you'd like to share that we have not covered?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. And yeah. I want to thank you for spotlighting the work, and thank you for the work that you are doing. I think it's the defining issue of our time. Let me ask Lad one thing. There is a group, AI Global, along with the World Economic Forum, is doing what I consider to be very important work. And so they have a responsible AI certification project underway where companies and designers and developers will be able to take their AI plans and projects, go to them as an independent third-party validator, have them vetted, and get a rating. So it's kind of like Consumer Reports or Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval or J.D. Power ratings, where there'll be a third-party entity that will be able to rate your project, your processes, rate your data, and even ultimately rate your company based on the criteria that we talked about fairness, transparency, accountability, along those types of standards.
Eventually, most companies there will be pressure for them to get that certification to prove that they're actually doing AI in an ethical way. Is that right?
Without question. And then it becomes a roadmap for regulators. So it's like the FDA has nutrition labels on food. You can't go into the market without a nutrition label and sell food in the United States, at least.
Right.
And if you don't, then you have to disclose these claims have not been approved by the FDA. So the consumer knows that you weren't willing to allow your work or your products or services to be vetted.
So eventually that's going to be happening. That's really good to know. And there's a tie there to the World Economic Forum. They're working on that AI Global, and they're doing that together.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So good to know. Thank you so much, Will. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your wisdom and enthusiasm. And this has just really been amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Myrna. I appreciate it. Be well.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.